Hi, I'm Sean. I've always been curious about the answers to life's big questions. I thought it would be cool to seek some of those answers through conversations with others on a similar path. My intention with these conversations is to inspire you to think bigger, to challenge what you believe to be possible. I'd like to invite you to think outside the lines. Hello and welcome to the Think Outside the Lines podcast, where we feature thought-provoking and inspiring conversations with guests who are doing their part to make the world a better place. I want to start today, as I do each episode, by asking you to take a moment and practice gratitude. Think of a few things in your life in this very moment that you're thankful for. Maybe it's something someone did for you. Maybe it's something you were fortunate enough to be able to do for someone in your life. Maybe it's the fact that you woke up today feeling healthy and blessed. Don't forget to take a moment or two each day to reflect on the things in your life that you're grateful for. Now, we've got an incredibly special episode for you today. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that it's probably one of the most fascinating and insightful conversations I've had on the show so far. I strongly encourage you to suspend your disbelief and just listen with an open mind. It's people like my guest today who are out there helping to facilitate some really intelligent conversation on the topic of consciousness. He's written an incredible new book entitled An End to Upside-Down Thinking, where he explores some of life's most challenging questions about who we are as human beings. In the book, he explores the idea that, contrary to mainstream assumptions, consciousness is not produced by the brain. His book has been endorsed by well-known thinkers like two-time Nobel Prize nominee Dr. Irvin Laszlo, Harvard neurosurgeon and number one New York Times bestselling author Eben Alexander, MD. Even Goldie Hawn said that while reading this book, new pathways of the mind will open and perhaps shift your perception of reality, time, and space, and above all, consciousness. Now, I can tell you that I first discovered him on another podcast, and I knew immediately that I wanted to have a conversation of my own with him. I really hope that you enjoy this incredibly insightful conversation as we think outside the lines with Mark Gober. Tell me what you believe to be the message that you were brought here to share with the world.
Well, I would say right now, my answer probably over time has changed, but at the moment, I feel most passionate about the message related to my book called An End to Upside Down Thinking, and the subtitle is Dispelling the Myth That the Brain Produces Consciousness and the Implications for Everyday Life. And I think that subtitle, thinking about our brain and our own consciousness, which is such a basic part of our existence, we're your listeners right now, they have an awareness. They're aware. I'm aware right now. You're aware. What is that? Where does it come from? And is it a product of the brain? So I feel most passionate about the science, which is actually challenging the conventional view that the reason that we are aware, the reason that we have a consciousness is solely due to stuff happening in our brain. Whereas I think the evidence suggests that the brain is not actually producing that awareness and that our identity, which is most closely tied to our consciousness, is not tied to our body.
Now, I'm so excited to dive into this content today. And for anyone listening to this conversation right now, I really think that these ideas might just change your life. And at the very least, I believe that they'll change how you perceive the world around you. Now, Mark, I was telling you a little bit before we started the interview that I actually heard you a few weeks ago on another podcast. And after listening to that episode, the themes that you address in your book, which we're going to get into more in depth in a little bit, but they've really stayed with me since listening. And I'm really excited to share this conversation with people who are listening to this one today. In the preface of your new book, An End to Upside Down Thinking, you warn the reader that they should, quote, suspend everything you thought you knew about reality. And I really encourage everyone listening today to do the same as they listen to this conversation. Before we dive into the material in the book, though, I want to begin, and I know this is a really big question, but I'd like to know how you define consciousness.
Yeah, it's a really important one. When I say that I am speaking to you right now, that I, that sense of identity, it's like a subjective inner experience. It's kind of hard to put your hands around, but it's an awareness that we know exists because we have it, and it's kind of our sense of identity. So that is what I'm defining as consciousness, to the extent that we can even define a term like that. So it's something that we all have. the mind is kind of a close corollary to the consciousness, but it's this awareness that we all possess.
Your career has taken you from Wall Street to Silicon Valley. What piqued your interest in this topic that seems kind of far removed, I guess you could say, from investment banking in the tech industry? And what made you want to write a book about it?
Yeah, it is very far removed. So I'm a partner at a firm in Silicon Valley called Sherpa Technology Group, where we advise technology companies, nothing to do with consciousness. Although some of the companies we work with in tech have something to do with AI, so you could say there's a relationship, but not really. But before that, I was in investment banking, and I can trace the interest maybe back to college. I almost decided to major in astrophysics when I was a student at Princeton, but I was on the tennis team, and I was too busy with that, and I couldn't have done the astrophysics major with the tennis team. So I ended up majoring in behavioral economics, meaning psychology as the basis, but looking at economics from that standpoint. So I've had interest in like existence and what we're doing in the universe for a really, really long time. But my conclusion about meaning in the universe was a pretty bleak one, because I thought that our consciousness, this awareness that we have, is just a product of things in our brain. And if you buy into that, then when your body and your brain die, then your consciousness is gone. So if you just think about that a lot, which is something I used to do, it's really hard to find meaning in life, because if something good happens during your life or something bad happens, does it really matter? Because you're going to be dead and your consciousness and your memories will be gone. So I really struggled with meaning and that, but I thought science pointed to that very bleak conclusion. So I didn't really question an alternative, but that shifted for me about 2 years ago for the first time when I heard a podcast. So the story was, I was listening to a health podcast called Extreme Health Radio, just listening to interesting health ideas. And the next one in the queue was a woman named Laura Powers, who described her own psychic abilities and her ability to work with energy. And these were totally foreign concepts to me. I mean, she was talking about communicating with people who were dead, like that their consciousness didn't die. It didn't change my life listening to that one podcast, but it was interesting because this was a person who sounded like she was serious, and she wasn't. It didn't sound like she was trying to fool people, but I didn't know how to even reason what she was saying. So at the end of that podcast, I remember she said, well, I have my own podcast where I interview other people who have these experiences too. So I said, oh, that's interesting. And it's called Healing Powers. I remembered the name, and I would just turn it on when I drive from San Francisco, where I live, to our office, which is down in the peninsula in Silicon Valley. And I would just leave her podcast on. And over a few weeks of listening to people that she interviewed, I realized that many of them were describing similar things about reality, which is that when someone's body dies, the consciousness doesn't die, and that some people are able to communicate with that consciousness, which was totally wild to me. And this idea of psychic abilities. And I just heard it too many times from people. And I'm like, wait, are they all delusional? Are they all lying?
Totally.
I mean, I couldn't, but then it got to the point where there's so many of them where I was like, wait, they're not even related to each other. These are totally independent cases. So I said, okay, I need to look into this. And I started to look at science, and that opened the floodgates, because I realized there was all kinds of science from the US government, from Princeton University, from the University of Virginia and beyond. And that led me down the course of a full year's worth of intense research, because I needed to rethink reality if there was this whole other picture going on. And as I got into that research, at first I didn't talk to people about it because it was so out there that I didn't – like I was self-conscious to talk about the things I was interested in, because most of my friends and family have no context for thinking about things like that. But as I became more confident in the research that I was doing and being confident in the way I could express it to people, I started to tell people. And the reactions I got were that like people's lives were shifting, or they'd say, Mark, I remember that dinner we had and you told me about the research you were doing and I haven't been able to stop thinking about it. It's like shifted how I'm thinking about things and I'm asking all kinds of questions. And I kept hearing this over and over again. So I said, all right, why don't I try to just put this on paper? And before then, I never had an intention of writing a book. I mean, this was not on my radar at all. So it was July of 2017 when I decided, okay, I'm going to try to put this on paper. And July 4th weekend that year was a four-day weekend. I didn't leave my apartment for 4 days, basically, and wrote a good chunk of the book that weekend. And then over the next few weekends in July, I finished it. So that was the process of how I wrote it. It was not something that was planned. And if you and I had talked 2 years ago, this would not have been on my radar.
This show actually began conversations about entrepreneurship. And I found that as I began to talk to people, that topic resonated less and less. And I was more interested in like the stories behind the people and even like more spiritual stuff. And as I started to have those sort of conversations, I got much different feedback from listeners that seemed to enjoy those conversations more themselves. And so it's interesting how the trajectory that you think you might be on can change. So like listening to your story has actually been really, really fascinating in that sense too.
I'm glad to hear that. And I've gotten that feedback from people a lot. So if other people are listening who are struggling to find passions, and maybe that's something I didn't add into my story, which is really important, is that I felt like something was missing in my life and I didn't know what it was for a really long time. Like I knew that there were passions that I wasn't exploring, but I couldn't figure out what those passions were. And it wasn't until I randomly stumbled across these concepts, but I could now in hindsight trace it back to my college years when I had big questions about existence. So if I had listened to that a little bit more closely, maybe I would have pursued those passions on the side of just trying to understand who and what I am and what the reality is that we're in. Because to me, the things I do in life should be related to the reality that we're in. Because if I don't understand the reality, then what am I doing? Like how do my actions and the things I do in my life and what I find meaningful, how do they even relate if I don't know what this universe is? So those are the big questions that I've been asking for a long time. And now I feel like I'm much more on the path of looking at what reality is and then matching my behaviors to align with it.
Yeah, I think there's just a general hunger right now in our society for the answers to these sort of questions. And I think that part of the issue is that no one was really asking them in a public forum before, right? Like people have always had the curiosity, but it's taken people like you to actually put yourself out there and say like, hey, I'm curious about this too. And I'm actually looking into some of the answers. And so what is upside down thinking?
When I say upside down thinking, I'm referring to the conventional perspective in science and actually much of Western thinking and perhaps even broader thinking than just the West, which is the following. It's called materialism, which is just a fancy way of saying that the universe began 13.8 billion years ago through some event that we call the Big Bang, and it filled the universe with physical material, hence the name materialism, that we call matter. So like atoms. Your table is made of atoms, physical stuff. That's what filled the universe. And in this big universe, you're bound through chance to end up with reactions between those pieces of matter. And we call that chemistry. So we started with matter, now we have chemistry. When you have enough random chemical reactions, through chance, you are bound to end up with a molecule that is self-replicating, like DNA, leading to biology. So we started with matter, then chemistry, now biology. And with biology, you end up with the evolution of a being, like a human being, that develops a brain. And then from the brain, consciousness, the mind, awareness emerges. So this perspective is that matter is fundamental and consciousness comes at the end. Matter creates consciousness through a brain. And that is what I'm challenging. And in particular, I'm challenging that last step, that the brain is what's producing consciousness.
So you believe there's evidence that our consciousness survives when our physical body dies. And I'm incredibly fascinated by this. I'd love for you to elaborate, but I want to kind of break it down based on some of the stuff that's actually in your book. So can you talk a little bit about remote viewers, first of all?
Yes. And even before I do that, to give your listeners some context for how these things might even be possible.
Yeah.
Because it sounds so out there if you've never heard of remote viewing. But if we look at materialism, which is saying that matter creates consciousness, and that's what I'm challenging. If we flip it and say, well, matter and like physics, which is the study of the material universe, physics, chemistry, biology, I'm not saying we should change those, but I'm saying that consciousness actually comes first before matter rather than at the end of the chain. So if we say consciousness is fundamental, which people like Max Planck, who was one of the founders of original guys in quantum physics, in 1931, he said, I regard consciousness as fundamental, and I regard matter as derivative from consciousness. If we think of consciousness as kind of being the basis of reality beyond space and time, then all of a sudden, you can imagine things like, well, when the body dies, consciousness doesn't die, because the consciousness wasn't dependent on the body in the first place. Or remote viewing, which we'll talk about, which is the ability for someone to perceive something meaning like you're seeing it, but your eyes are not seeing it. It's something that's far away, and in your mind, you're able to actually perceive it. Well, if consciousness is the basis of everything, maybe somehow you're able to access things with your brain that sound far-fetched. But it really results in a rethinking of both reality and the brain. So I like to think of reality along the lines of what Dr. Bernardo Kastrup says, who's a philosopher. He says, imagine that reality is like a stream of water, where water represents consciousness. And each of us is like a whirlpool within that stream of consciousness. So meaning we're made of water, we're made of consciousness, but we're having a localized, individuated experience almost. So you could imagine that someone who's a localized whirlpool would be able to open up their whirlpool a little bit to access a different part of the stream, because it's all part of the stream. And that's something like potentially this idea of remote viewing, which is that we're able to access something outside of what is localized to us. And that's what the phenomenon is. And that this is one of many phenomena that I describe in the book, which challenges the view that the brain produces consciousness. Because if we think that the brain produces consciousness, how could you see something when your eyes aren't there to see it? Doesn't make any sense. Your consciousness is supposed to be just confined to your body and to your head. But if the consciousness is everywhere, it's a matter of just accessing it. So what is the evidence that remote viewing is even a real thing? Because I have not personally remote viewed that I'm aware of, and many people I've talked to have never done it. But the U.S. government ran a program for more than 20 years on this exact topic, using what they called psychic spies to use remote viewing to locate things. And within the last few years, the CIA has declassified documents on this topic. And I include a few of them in my book, and I'll give a direct quote from the CIA's declassified documents. Remote viewing is a real phenomenon. That's what it says. And then it says implications are revolutionary. And then they show a science panel that looked at this and some credible people, including someone from Caltech. And then the next slide says evidence too impressive to dismiss as mere coincidence. I mean, that alone, I think, is really interesting.
Are there specific examples that you found?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's some. Now, I should say that the remote viewers themselves who have been involved in these projects, they've been saying for years that this is real and that they were doing it. The physicists, the laser physicists at Stanford who administered these tests, they've been saying that it's real. Like Russell Targ, for example, he wrote a book on this in 2012 talking all about the evidence that has been shown for this. One example I really like is former President Jimmy Carter. He said publicly that remote viewers were used to find a lost Russian bomber that was lost in an African jungle, and they couldn't locate it. They used remote viewers to find this downed bomber that they couldn't find otherwise. So that means there were people in the U.S. and who knows where else, maybe they were using their minds to locate where this thing was that was not able to be found through other means. So that's one example where it's, again, it doesn't really make sense according to conventional views, but there are people with really, really strong abilities apparently that are able to do this. And maybe it's like we all have the abilities to some degree, but we're not harnessing them. And some people, sort of like in basketball, Michael Jordan is an amazing natural talent who's harnessed those talents. You have really, really good people who are kind of on one end of the spectrum of the distribution curve, and then you have other people that are more normal at this and we are not able to do things like the people in the U.S. government program.
That's so fascinating to me. I want to dive into a little more about like the precognition element stuff in a second, but you tell a story in the book about I'm a dog person, and they did a study with dogs that were able to sense when their owner was deciding to come home. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's amazing. And if your listeners are interested in this, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake has done these studies, and you can go to his website, actually, and he has a video of the study. So I'll explain to you what it is. There are many dog owners and pet owners in general who say, I think my pet like knows my thoughts, or they know how I'm feeling, or they seem to know when I'm coming home. So Dr. Sheldrake, who's a Cambridge-trained biochemist, put this to the test using controls. And there was one dog in particular named JT, and the owner's name is Pam, who had a particularly strong, allegedly telepathic relationship. In other words, the dog seemed to go to the window when the owner, Pam, was coming home. And what Sheldrake did was he had cameras set up at Pam's home watching the dog. He would send Pam off in a taxi at random times. So we couldn't claim that, oh, the dog just happened to remember when Pam was coming home, randomize the times, put her off in a cab. So it wasn't even the sound of her normal car. And miles away, this woman, Pam, would be sent out in a cab, and she was with an experimenter. And nobody knew when she was going to come home except an experimenter who was far away. They would call the experimenter who was with Pam and say, okay, it's time for you to come home. Pam would start walking to a cab to come home, and you see in the video that the dog, when she decides that she's going to come home, seconds later, the dog goes to the window.
It's so crazy.
It's crazy. It is. And he ran close to 200 trials and has written journal papers on this. And it seems that there is an above chance relationship between Pam's decision to come home and the dog's moving to the window. So it's super controversial because it's suggesting that there is kind of a telepathic relationship that's existing, so something non-physical. But if we think about the whirlpool analogy again, it's kind of like one whirlpool opens up a little bit and allows in water from another whirlpool. It's like the consciousness of one is kind of subtly entering the consciousness of another. And your listeners might be wondering, like, how have I not heard about this before? And that's certainly what I've asked. There are a lot of reasons for this. It's a controversial topic and there's resistance. But in this particular case, I've been amazed to learn in reading from Dr. Sheldrake's account of this that when he put out these studies, there was massive resistance to it. And there were people who were skeptical that tried to replicate the studies, and they ran four trials, and then they came out saying that they were not able to replicate it and that Sheldrake's studies were fraudulent. But years later, when Sheldrake and even an independent scientist, Dr. Radin, looked at the results that the skeptic studies, and it showed that their four accounts matched statistically what Sheldrake had shown. But by that time, the damage had been done publicly, and everyone thought the studies were fraudulent. So it's like really hard to weed through a lot of this, you know, things that you read in the media. But for me, when you aggregate the amount of evidence, whether it's this one study from Dr. Sheldrake or the remote viewing, and that's why I put it all together in one book, I think it's really hard to knock down every single one of them. It starts to become far-fetched to say that they were all fraudulent.
Totally. And I think if you, speaking to animals specifically, I know that like anyone that's ever had a dog, for example, before, I think you just feel this inherent connection that is like indescribable. I want to talk more about precognition. That word to me feels very like Minority Report-esque. But you have some really interesting stories about this in your book, too, that I'd love for you to maybe talk about.
Mm-hmm. So precognition is the idea that you can know the future before the future is known. So it's, if we think of consciousness again as being fundamental beyond space and time, it's like consciousness is reaching forward in time because it's beyond time. Okay, so at least conceptually it's possible under this alternative framework. But is that true in reality? There have been a number of studies, again, highly controversial, because what this is suggesting is that like the linear notion of time we have, past to present to future, is perhaps not correct in the way that we perceive it. And that is mind-blowing. But I mean, if we look at what Einstein has showed with relativity theory, if you're moving at a really fast speed, we know that time basically is relative depending on how fast you're going. So we know at the very least time is not fixed, it's relative. It can slow down or speed up. Someone's clock changes depending on how fast they're going or depending on the gravitational force. So at the very least, we know that that's going on. But now what we're talking about is like a reversal in the arrow of time or something else. What's the evidence for that? There are studies that are known as presentiment studies, which is kind of a subset of precognition, where the body is sensing something unconsciously before the future is known. And the classic study reverses in time a classic psychological study, which is I remember from my studies in psychology, where you show someone a picture of like a violent image, and then you measure their physiology. You measure their skin, their eyes, their brain, their heart, and you know that it will spike unconsciously just because the person sees an arousing image and something happens in the body where it responds to it. What the experimenters have done more recently is to say, well, let's measure the body before the picture is shown. And we're not even going to tell the person that a violent image is coming because they don't know if it's going to be a violent image or an erotic image or a peaceful one, like a river or a mountain or something. So what they do is they measure the person's body physiology before a computer randomly generates one of those pictures, meaning that even the experimenters don't know which pictures are going to show up. And what the experimenters find when they look at the statistics, again, it's a very small effect, is that the body seems to react, meaning the skin, the pupils, the brain, the heart, they react very subtly seconds before the computer randomly generates the image in a direction consistent with what the computer eventually shows. It's really, I mean, it's a controversial area, of course, because it's challenging so many views. And if you start Googling around many of these ideas, you might see, oh, this was debunked or it's fraudulent. But I mean, again, if you put it all together, I haven't seen the evidence suggesting that all of these are fraudulent. And this is a case where the meta-analysis is really important. And the meta-analysis means when you're combining all of the different studies together, you look at the cumulative results. And there have been a number of meta-analyses from Dr. Daryl Bem, who's a former Cornell professor. Dr. Julia Mossbridge has looked at this as well. And you get an effect using statistics that is way beyond chance, like over a billion to one. Six sigma is the technical term, meaning the odds that this is just a chance anomaly is more than a billion to one.
You've mentioned that all of this research has changed your perspective on a lot of things. What do you believe happens when we die?
Well, I would have said to you before the research that I did is that the consciousness is produced by the brain. So when your brain dies, it's over. There are no memories and that's it. And there's a life that is not meaningful, but that's just the sad truth of reality. Now I think that consciousness is not dependent on the body, and the brain is acting almost like an antenna or a filtering mechanism for consciousness. So we're not producing the signal, so to speak, but the signal is coming from outside the body. And that means when the body dies, the signal itself has not disappeared. So what is the evidence that that is true beyond just that conceptual framework? I think the near-death experience is so important, and I can't believe more scientists aren't looking at this seriously, because I think traditionally it's been thought that, oh, well, people report seeing the light and they have this life review and they're hovering over their bodies. That is a hallucination that's caused by the brain, because once the brain's about to die, it spits out chemicals and it causes this hallucination. That is a theory, number one. There is no evidence that that is actually what's happening. People have theorized that that's what's happening, but when you look at the evidence, I think it's challenging that idea, because there are cases such as Dr. Pim Van Lommel's research. He's a cardiologist who ran a study that was published in the Lancet Journal, which is a very credible scientific journal. And these are cases of people who are in cardiac arrest, meaning they're clinically dead. Their heart has stopped. There's no blood flow to the brain after a certain amount of time. And yet a percentage of the people in his studies after they were resuscitated, 18%. Okay, so not everybody, but 18% are reporting this experience when their brain is technically off. It should be 0% if the brain is what is the exclusive producer of consciousness. So it's suggesting that there is the existence of consciousness and memories independent of a body that's functioning.
So fascinating. So many questions.
This is why I had to write a book.
No, totally. Totally. So with respect to something like past lives, this is something that's always fascinated me, because I definitely believe that we've been here before and we'll be here again. But I personally think that if you pay enough attention, there's evidence of that everywhere. But specifically in regard to like intuition, I meet people all the time whose energy just resonates immediately in ways that I can't explain. And then, of course, you meet people that completely do not resonate in any way. And so I have to believe that there's something to that. What is your perspective on past lives?
Again, if you had asked me this a few years ago, I would have said, how is that even possible? There's no way. But if we take this whirlpool analogy just conceptually, it's like someone's whirlpool stops being a whirlpool, i.e. the body dies, but the water just transitions into the stream, and then it's like another whirlpool forms. So the body is kind of – the water's effectively recycled, just to put it into like human terms, and the consciousness hasn't left the stream. It just changes form and it takes on a new experience. What's the evidence for that? Well, the University of Virginia has run studies for more than 50 years and looked at over 2,500 cases of children, usually between the ages of 2 and 5 years old, who start talking about a previous life, meaning a life that's not theirs. So these are little kids speaking very specifically about things such as, you know, this is how I died. They start having preferences for things that don't make sense, like alcohol or tobacco. They have very specific fears. like a child feared water when in the past life that they drowned. And I think in the most compelling cases, the children actually have birthmarks and physical deformities that match how they describe dying in the previous life. And in some cases, the researchers are able to find a person that died in that exact manner. So, I mean, I don't know how to explain these things other than it's the consciousness of somebody else that's taking on a new body. Because if we think, according to conventional views, that the only reason that our physical form exists in the way that it does, and the only things that actually matter are our genetics and our environment, then how is it that we have something going on where a person has physical changes that are not genetic and they're not environmental, where it's some person who lived in a different era and something is being transmitted into this physical form? It's the researchers at UVA call it a third factor, something that's not genetic, not environmental. So there's a third factor that affects our bodies that medicine is not currently incorporating. I mean, think about how many advances we might be missing because we're just ignoring this other factor.
Yeah, and I want to talk more about the science in just a second, but I want to talk specifically about the brain for a moment, because I feel like as much as we've studied about the brain, we still know very little, right? What impact, you mentioned the antenna analogy before, which actually really, I really like that. I think that's really easy to understand. But what impact do you believe that the brain has on consciousness, and what role do you think it actually plays in all of this?
It's an important point. I'm not making the case that the brain has no role in consciousness. The brain is highly related to it. And I think of the brain as a processor of consciousness, or I think a filter or a limiter is, or reducing valve is a more accurate analogy, where there is some broader reality, some broader stream of consciousness that's out there. But we are, our brain is limiting what we actually experience. And the evidence that the brain is kind of a limiter of consciousness rather than a producer, there are a number of cases where we see reduced brain functioning associated with enriched or heightened experience. In other words, it's as if our brain, when it's very functional, is clouding out the broader reality. But when we reduce the brain functioning, we actually have more exposure to it. So things like meditation, when people have insights in meditation, for example, that might be a small version of that, of like the quieting of the mind allows the brain to receive things or to access the broader reality. But I think more extreme cases of that are like the near-death experience, when people talk about things as being like realer than real, when their brain is either highly impaired or completely off. That's reduced brain functioning, heightened experience. Another example, psychedelics. Now, we're just getting back into studying psychedelics because there was kind of a hiatus in research because of the controversy around it. But now people are starting to study psychedelics more formally. And there was a study in 2012, people who took psilocybin, which is the active compound in magic mushrooms, they found that there was reduced brain functioning associated with the psychedelic trips. So meaning people were tripping on mushrooms and feeling like they had this, you know, very enriched reality as a result of taking the substance, and yet they had reduced brain functioning. That's another example. Another one is savant syndrome. These are people like in the movie Rain Man. It was based off of someone named Kim Peek, who had incredible mental abilities, mathematical abilities, memory, amazing things, but was very impaired in other ways because the brain had certain differences relative to a brain that's more commonly found in the population. So we see impairments in the brain in certain savants, and yet we see enriched abilities. So there's this pattern that you wouldn't necessarily predict if the brain produced consciousness. We might expect to see more brain activity associated with these heightened experiences or heightened abilities. And yet we see the reverse, which is matching the notion that the brain is a limiter or a filtering mechanism for consciousness.
Yeah, some of the studies I've seen specifically around like psilocybin that you alluded to a moment ago, the work that I find most interesting is the stuff that they've done around like terminally ill patients or people with anxiety. That's mind-boggling, just because we've associated that with something negative for so long. And if there's actually studies that say that it can help people in smaller dosages, that's completely life-altering, right?
Mm-hmm. And it could change how we look at how we start treating mental illnesses. I think Absolutely. We're still in the early phases of researching it, because there some people can have adverse reactions, and we don't want to harm people with the substances we're giving. But, I mean, there was a study at Johns Hopkins using psilocybin on cancer patients, and a large portion of them said it was one of the most meaningful events in their life, and yeah, they weren't fearing death as much after one dose.
Yeah, that's insane. A lot of this stuff, I'm sure, is really controversial. how has like mainstream wisdom had an impact on your work, and what kind of responses have you received from the skeptics?
Well, as of the recording of this interview, the book has been out for about a week and a half. So I'm still waiting on some of the responses. But I'll say that my not being a scientist and not being in academia probably allowed me to do things that many scientists might just be more hesitant to do.
Yeah.
Because I'm just kind of a citizen and I'm reporting what I'm seeing as facts and what studies are showing. But this is highly, highly controversial and probably more controversial than any of us on this call can understand.
Totally.
Unless we're in academia. In that environment, like I've talked to many of the scientists, if you want to study these things and get tenure, like you better wait until you get tenure to talk about them. That's what they're telling me over and over again.
What do you believe, and I know this is a super like loaded question, but what do you believe are some of the implications of this work in terms of science and medicine?
I think it will revolutionize science and medicine.
Yeah.
Because we are working in most of science under this materialist perspective that consciousness is a byproduct of the brain. It has no effect on the physical world. It is localized to the body. But if those things are not true and consciousness is the basis of physical reality, I mean, that has to revolutionize physics, first of all. And then all of science has to incorporate it, which it's not currently doing. So I think we'll see major advances. And that's one of the reasons I felt so compelled to put the evidence out there to hopefully stimulate further interest and allow people to feel more comfortable talking about these things of, oh, well, what about the studies that Mark put in his book? Like just kind of to open the public forum for it in one place.
Yeah. You also have some interesting theories, I think probably coming from the tech perspective in your background, but like on artificial intelligence, what can you talk a little bit about this?
It's really important because we hear people like Elon Musk and others saying that AI is a threat to the world. And I think there are threats to AI. Like a human being can program a computer to do some pretty bad things because we have strong computing technology and we're only getting better at it. The big question that's out there is like, can we make a machine conscious, as in the show Westworld, where all of a sudden the machines become so complex that they develop memories and then they start to have feelings and then they have their own interests. Can that actually happen? And I think there is an assumption in mainstream media that, oh, well, yeah, that can happen because the brain is like a computer. And once we figure out how the computer works, we're going to figure out how consciousness comes out. So let's just make a really complex computer and then we're going to have conscious AI and we better watch out because they're going to have desires and they're going to start trying to take over the world because they have emotions. That's the step that I would challenge now based on the research that I'm doing, which is that if the brain is not producing consciousness, if matter does not create consciousness, can we create artificial intelligence that is sentient, that has emotions and feelings? I would argue that we cannot artificially create that part of it. And there are people like Federico Faggin, who's one of the original inventors of the microprocessor, so a very credible scientist in this area. He has been coming out saying something very similar in recent months on this topic, that we're not going to be able to create conscious AI. AI could be dangerous for certain reasons, but it will not be conscious because we can't create a conscious machine. However, I will say this, like obviously our brain is related to consciousness in some way, and I don't think we fully understand how it is that the brain is processing consciousness. Like what are the mechanisms? How does biology, is it receiving it? Is it like, how are they interacting? Maybe if we understood how the brain is interacting with consciousness, maybe we could create that in something artificial. I don't know. Can we create an artificial receiver of consciousness? That is, I think, unknown until we understand the relationship between the brain and consciousness. But I think the broader point here is that what we're seeing on TV shows and in the mainstream media, I think some of the fears might be too extreme.
Yeah. So I think like Sam Harris, I'm sure you're familiar with his work and like he has a great podcast. He has some really interesting arguments just for like responsible AI, if that makes sense. And one of the most interesting things that he's talked about that I've actually like, I think is something that people are obviously thinking about right now is as we think more about like self-driving cars and that sort of thing. And can you program into that software some sort of like empathy, or how do you program a sense of like morality, for example? So if the car has to make a decision, do I kill the driver or the pedestrian? You know, how does it reconcile those things? And should it? How should it, right? So I don't know. AI is really fascinating. And I think that, again, to your point, like as we learn more about things like consciousness, don't know, possibilities are endless, I suppose.
Yep, I think we have to understand the consciousness question first, because until then, I think the machines will be a product of their programmers. So it's up to the programmers to put morality into the machines of, if this situation comes up, basically we are deciding how the machine is going to act. The machine is not independently going to do that, because we don't know how to create a conscious machine, and it's possible that we never can.
After people are introduced to this sort of thinking, and some of this work, that they perceive life differently. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me too, because I'm just seeing it over and over again, where it's sort of like you can't, once you see something or hear something once, you can't unsee it or you can't unhear it, because it opens up this whole other realm of possibilities to explain things in your life that previously might have been closed off because you just didn't consider those possibilities. And whether you believe those possibilities or not is a different question, but the fact that it's a possibility in the solution set, so to speak, changes everything, because it's like, oh, I see this phenomenon. Wait, how does that relate to brain and consciousness? You have to rethink everything that you assumed in your life. At least that's been my personal experience in this new context of a different possible reality.
Yeah. And for me, I think like if death isn't this horrible, scary thing to be afraid of, then maybe we can enjoy life in a different way. Right. Because it's not the end necessarily. This is just something that we get to experience, and we should try to get all we can out of it. Right.
I think that's one of the big, big implications for people, because whether it's an explicit or an implicit under the surface fear, it probably drives a lot of our behaviors of the fear that this is it. But if this is not it, and there have been many things before, because consciousness is even beyond time, then it in some ways it puts more pressure on the living phase, because it means there are potentially consequences, because it's not just over when you die. But at the same time, it might also be relieving, because this is not the end. So I found many people have said to me that this view of reality is ultimately a very comforting one. And actually, in the past, I probably would have said, well, that is a reason to discount all these theories because it's so comforting. I would have said, well, it's because it's so comforting, it must not be true. It must be a rationalization. And what I've now realized is the error in that logic is that I discounted the possibility that something could be both comforting and true at the same time. I kind of eliminated that as a possibility.
How does it change your perspective on something like suffering?
Yeah. When I talk to people who've had near-death experiences and read about their experiences, what they often say is that they don't fear death after the experience, because they realize that they can't deny what they went through, and they know that death is not a real thing, meaning the consciousness continues. But what they say is that they do fear suffering in the body, even though they don't fear death. So what is the purpose of that suffering? This is where it starts to become a bit more inferential, where we have to take a bit of a leap of faith and start of kind of say we have this base set of facts, and what does it mean without necessarily being able to prove it. Where I come out at the moment, based on like the research that I've done, is that the suffering we experience is part of learning, typically, that we are experiencing while in the body, where there is this broader consciousness that's part of the stream that is like kind of learning through all kinds of experiences in the physical realm. And suffering is part of that learning experience sometimes. And depending on the nature of it, it might result in a different learning experience.
Yeah, that's a really interesting topic. I recently heard someone say that I was fascinated by. They said, we're not afraid of death, we're afraid of how we're going to die. And actually, I think that's kind of profound.
Yeah.
In addition to your book, I understand you're launching a podcast, which I'm incredibly excited for. What is it called, and what can we expect to learn about?
It does not have a formal name yet.
Okay.
And in terms of launch time, I mean, I've interviewed over 40 people, and they're recorded, and I'm working with a producer to make it into a really formal show that we hope people can absorb.
Yeah.
What can people expect? Well, we'll probably have two versions of it. One is just the raw interviews themselves, and the other version might be more of a scripted thing where I'm narrating and we use clips from the different interviews, but we're still working that out. But in terms of the people that you can expect to hear from, it's many of the scientists that I talk about in my book. So ranging from people like Rupert Sheldrake, who talks about the dog studies, to Brian Josephson, who's a Nobel Prize winner in physics, who talks about telepathy as being something he thinks is real. This is a Nobel Prize winner in physics. And then many people who have had near-death experiences.
Awesome. I love it. I can't wait. When do you think you're going to launch it?
Hopefully in the next few months. I want to get it out as soon as I can. And the reason I wanted to do that is I know from my personal experience, reading was helpful, but also listening to people talk about their science and talk about their research and their own personal experiences really helped solidify things for me. So when you hear me quote someone in my book or read it, it's different than listening to the person's voice of, I was hovering over my body. I was cradled by a being of light. And this is when they were, you know, after a horrible accident, they're in this out-of-body state. It's like, what's going on there?
What do you hope will be the legacy of your work in this realm?
Well, I think we're at a really pivotal point in human history where we're going to go one way of destroying ourselves in the worst case or shift things. And I think that these ideas that we're talking about here and that I hope we have a broader conversation might be the solution to it. Because if we're not finite beings, meaning if we don't die when our body dies, and if we're not as separate as we think we are, if we're actually connected as part of the same underlying consciousness, which is what a lot of these ideas are suggesting, then how do we treat each other? And do these wars that we're seeing, does violence, do all these things make any sense? I think it's actually irrational to do harm to someone if it's true that we're actually the same. It puts a new spin on things like altruism, which is helping other people. It actually becomes selfish to be altruistic because you're helping yourself. It flips all the paradigms. So I hope that this work will stimulate the conversation and make it more acceptable for people to talk about these things in a mainstream setting, whereas it's kind of been shunned traditionally. And the number of people that have come up to me already and said, or emailed me or whatever, they say, Mark, I've had this experience. I haven't been comfortable telling anyone about it. I mean, so many people have these experiences that match up with the research, and there's just not a forum for being able to discuss it currently.
Yeah. And bringing it to light, I think is, like I said before, I think it's half the battle. So thank you for shedding the light on it that you are. Please tell our listeners how they can connect with you and where they can get the book.
Well, thank you so much, Sean, and thanks for having me. They can get the book on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and many bookstores. Also, my website has more information about the book and about me and the podcast, so we'll be announcing it on social media and also through my website and mailing list. My website is my name, Mark Gober, MarkGober.com, and that's where we will be sharing updates.
All right, I want to thank Mark for joining me today. I'd also like to thank you for listening. Now, if you're enjoying the show, please subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It is the best way for new listeners to discover the show. And please share this episode with anyone you think could benefit from hearing it. Now, you can find the links for everything we talk about in the show notes, which can be found over at thinkoutsidethelines.com. And feel free to drop me a line with any questions or feedback on the show. You can send an email anytime to hello@thinkoutsidethelines.com. Until next time, go out there and pursue your passion today, because the best way to predict the future is to create it. For more information, please visit thinkoutsidethelines.com.